A few weeks ago, I published a list of my highest conviction crypto bets. And if you look at that list over here, what you'll see is that we've got tokens like Arweave, Solana, Telegram, Near, Rune, Sui, and a whole lot of others. These are the tokens that I have the most conviction in for the cycle. And if you look at the price movements in the last week or so, what you realize is that the tokens that are moving the fastest are the ones on my list. Now, the reality is that that's no coincidence. And the reason is we spend a lot of time doing research, speaking to VCs and finding out what they all think before we actually publish these lists. Today, I've got a very, very, very special treat for you. I've actually got the same VCs that give me the information coming onto the show right here, and they are going to share with you their highest conviction bets. It's going to be a great, great, great show. So let's get the show on the road. Let's go. You know, they say no one man is an army. If you want to be making good calls and if you want to be getting good crypto research, you need to have a good team of researchers behind you. And here at Banter, I've got like 10 researchers here that just power one of my shows. I've also got these guys speaking to the VCs every single day, finding out exactly what all the VCs think. And that is where we bring you the research from. And as I said, today I've got a very special show for you, because today what we're going to do is we've got three of the top VCs in this place. We've got Haseeb from Dragonfly Capital. We've got Abhishek from Electric Capital, and we've got Paul here, who's here from Pantera. And those are effectively the three biggest VCs in the crypto space today, and they are going to tell you what their highest conviction bets are for the cycle. But before we get into it, first of all, smash the like button if you haven't already smashed the like button. Subscribe to the channel as quickly as you can. And I want to just remind you that our Friday shows are brought to you by NordVPN. Now, guys, I don't know about you, but when I read this story over here, it gave me the chills, and I really want you guys to see the story over here. So you've all used HelloSign. You know that whole HelloSign? Well, HelloSign is actually owned by Dropbox. And what they revealed this weekend was that they disclosed a breach of their HelloSign digital signature service. In the breach, what they were saying is that they accessed emails, username, passwords, account settings of anyone that used HelloSign. Okay, so if you've used the HelloSign or the Dropbox signing service, your data may have been compromised. Now, why am I telling you this? Because, guys, we're in crypto. We're surfing these sites every single day. We want to remain anonymous. If our computers get hacked, they're going to take our money. You need to make sure that you're protected. And the best way to protect yourself is to use a NordVPN. Now, there's a good reason why you need to use NordVPN. There is a link below. Just click this link and get yourself a VPN. When you get a VPN, not only do you mask your IP address, you can see like my IP address is completely transparent now, but you also get things like key protection, password managers, and stuff like that all here. And if you sign up with this deal, you get 30-day money-back guarantee and you pay less than $3 a month. You pay $2.98 a month. So guys, do that and protect yourselves. Also, if you are worried that you have been exposed in one of those hacks, you need to get Nord Threat Protect and Nord Incogni, which there's a link for all of them in the descriptions, okay? So go and get those. It'll cost you less than $6 a month. But number one, you remove yourself from all these spam databases. You remove yourself from all these unwanted databases. You protect yourself from all these websites that are malicious and could hack your wallets and your keys. And of course, you make your surfing completely anonymous, which is exactly where you want to be in crypto. All right, guys, now that the formalities are out the way, and now that I know you're all signing up for a VPN, go ahead, do it. I'm going to wait. So just as we were getting bored, the market decided to actually wake up this weekend. I think the big question for everyone is whether this is the beginning of a proper bounce and we've had enough chop and we've been chopped up enough, or whether this is just another fake bounce and we're going to go back into that choppy zone like we do every year after the halving, and we're going to go there. And I think to start that discussion, I'm going to bring in our guests. And I must warn you, ladies and gentlemen, I have to warn you that today I have a very special panel for you guys. I have three VCs. I ask you that you be very kind to them, because in this cycle, VCs are getting killed. The public perception of VCs is absolutely getting destroyed. But these are the good guys. These are three of the good guys. Guys, welcome and welcome back. I guess we were discussing earlier in the waiting room that this cycle, it has become that the VCs have become like the most hated the ones that are getting rebelled against, and the you know, like as part of this revolution. Are you guys feeling that out there? Avishal, Haseeb, are you feeling it out there?
I just feel love. I just feel every time I go on Twitter, I feel a bear hug of love.
Well, I mean, what do you think it is? Why do you think that all of a sudden? I mean, is it all of a sudden that people are that retail investors are kind of rebelling against the horrible VCs?
Well, it's always a function of which VCs, right? It's generally speaking, every cycle there's crappy VCs who end up kind of doing the very low quality projects, the pump and dumps, the super low float type stuff, and those things are not good for retail investors. There's like some specific things that are happening that I think piss people off, and then there's the general phenomenon that there's been this sentiment that, hey, this VC coin thing where VCs back this technology project and they invest very early and then it goes live at a multi-billion valuation and retail doesn't get to participate in any of it. There's a sense that, okay, maybe we should just jettison this whole game and instead just invest in meme coins. And there, you know, there's no pre-sales, there's no insiders, or, you know, maybe there's a team or something, but there's much fewer insiders who own supply of this thing. And maybe this whole story about technology and creating a better internet or creating a better crypto financial rails, maybe it's all bullshit. And why do we even buy into this game to begin with? So I think that's the narrative. And it kind of shows up, as Avishal was saying, it kind of shows up every cycle, but it does feel like it's particularly strong this cycle. The sentiment of like, hey, we're kind of over it.
Can I throw something at you? And maybe this is a thesis for it, but generally when I think about a traditional VC outside of crypto, I think about a VC that's taken a position in a company and waited for 3, 4, 5, 6 years before they get like any kind of opportunity for liquidity. And I don't see really any opportunity for those kind of VCs to dump on retail investors, because, you know, the path to get to the NASDAQ or the path to get to liquidity is quite a long path. But in crypto, I see a different path. I see a company raising today at a $10 million or $20 or $30 million valuation, and that's usually taken up by the VCs. And then 3 months later, they're going for the next round, and the next round is at a multiple of the first round. And a year later, they are at 100 times the first round. And then they come onto the market and they create very quick liquidity. And then I think that is what, you know, as a retail investor, I would probably be getting a little bit upset about, is the fact that the time in a normal VC cycle versus the time in a crypto VC cycle is a very different time period. And the opportunity to get liquidity, whereas in the traditional market, it's very hard to get liquidity because you've got to go through a stringent SEC process. Here, you just get onto the shitcoin decks, and then the VCs who are not locked up can actually dump on the retail investor. So, I mean, do you not think that might be where the frustration comes in when you look at
this? This is what I meant when I said it really depends on the VC, right? So you just described, you know, a project that basically takes seed funding, goes to quickly raise a follow-on A, follow-on B, you know, have huge multiples, launch on a DEX, and then the VCs dump immediately, okay? Nobody who's on this show, like none of the VCs that are really doing this at scale in Silicon Valley, we all have massive lockups when we invest into any of these projects. Usually for us, it's 4-year end-to-end vesting. When we invest in a project in the early stages, they're building some real shit. They can't go from a seed round to having a token live in less than a year, right? So the people who are investing in the stuff that, you know, most of the time when we invest in a project, it's multiple years before they turn what they are building, which is some unique technology, into something that can actually launch a token. And so it's multiple years until you get to actually being able to launch a token, a mainnet, a testnet, whatever. And then from there, it's 4 years end to end for us to get all of our tokens. And for most of these situations, people know what our addresses are. So we can't just go in and start dumping day one, because everyone's going to be like, oh my God, you know, this VC that's supposed to have confidence in this project is all of a sudden dumping everything. So it's really the kind of low integrity, fast money VCs, or VCs, quote unquote, who are investing in stuff that's flipping day one on a DEX, there's no lockups, they're dumping on retail. That kind of stuff just doesn't happen. And if you're talking about the really successful projects, right, the 100Xs like you described, those projects, you know, if you think about the Uniswaps and the Solanas, these things generally are very hard to build. They're very, very rare. Most of the things that you invest into as a VC do not become 100Xs. If it did, you know, I don't know, we'd be we'd be making way more money. We'd all be retired. So no, most things that you invest in don't make it. Most things you invest in, you know, startups are hard. Most startups fail. And so the few startups that do end up becoming these really big success stories, like the Uniswaps, the Solanas, the Monads, the Avalanches, they're hard technologies to build. They take a lot of time.
Let me ask you. I mean, you guys have all got amazing funds with amazing reputations, every single one of you. I mean, we've got, I think, I don't think you can get a better panel of VCs here. What's your success rate? Like, if I were to say to you, like, I know none of your funds are very, very old, except maybe Pantera is like the oldest fund here. But what is your success rate? And let me define success for you. Success is how many projects do you believe you've invested in that you haven't been able to get your money back. So let's not worry about the ones that actually. How many did you not get your money back on? See, everyone's going quiet here. So I think Avishal,
go for it, Avishal.
Well, I'm just thinking the problem or the challenge or the opportunity is it takes a while to know, especially in crypto, right? It's just like if you manage your capital well as a company, you may not have a lot of traction, but if the founder keeps going for 3, 4, 5 years, they might hit the next crypto upcycle and then it works. So let's take sort of one of my favorites as an example, obviously, and nothing I say or anybody here says.
Nothing's financial advice, yeah.
Obviously, but take something like Near.
Yeah, I know.
But take something like Near, right? Like Ilya worked on AI stuff for years. He was on the Transformer paper. I think all three of us might be investors in Near. I think we are.
All four of us. Yeah. All four of us.
And so we were seed investors. Yeah, all four of us. Yeah. So, you know, Electric and I think Kazeeb back at Metastable prior to Dragonfly and Paul was very early. Like we were investors in like 2018. Only in like 2024 did that thing really kind of like find its footing. Right. So it took 6 years for that thing to even work. So to your question of like, you know, there are a lot of people in 2021 that are like, this thing's dead. Like, it's just never going to work. And here we are 3 years after that, and Ilya's back and running the thing, and it's going well, right? Like they have built a bunch of cool stuff, and it's scaled. The sharding stuff works. Like their DA layer works. Like it just takes a long time. So the reason I sort of hesitated was not because I don't want to say. I think it's actually in practice until you're like 7 or 8 years in, it's actually quite hard to say because there might be a thing like Near that a bunch of people would write off. And then you look
around,
you know, 3, 4 years later and the founder's grinding, right? And it works. So it's actually in practice quite hard to say.
I do want to talk about Near a lot more because I actually do want to dig into what Ilya is doing and why the change in perception. But just do you think that as a VC fund, you have a higher success rate or a lower success rate than other tech funds? So as a crypto VC fund, do you think that you have a higher or lower success rate than a normal tech fund? And the reason why I ask is because in crypto, you have quicker liquidity, so you have a much quicker exit, right? So if I think of a traditional Sand Hill Road tech investor, for them, it was 1-0 because either the founder made it or they ran out of money and there was no liquidity along the way. For the VCs, I agree with you that you have lockup. I understand the lockup, but generally you do get 5% of your tokens on TGE or maybe 5% after 3 months or 10% after TGE or stuff like that. And you do have the option to sell.
Generally a year after TGE. Pretty much never is it 3 months or
6 months
usually
if you're
a U.S. investor.
Well, yeah, for a U.S. investor these days, it's like at least a year.
Okay, so that's governed by the legislation.
Ron, to your point, but setting aside the specifics for a second, I think the meta point that I think Haseeb made is the right one, which is there's no like accreditation to say you're a VC. So there are all these people that are not actually venture capital investors running around pretending to be VCs, and they don't actually do the things that good VCs do. They don't back things for multiple years. They're not willing to take a 4-year lockup. They're not willing to actually roll up their sleeves and help. And so I actually understand like the type of VC that retail hates, we also don't like because they make us look bad. Mm. To your question, actually, specifically around tech investors, I think there's two ways to think about that. One is there's actually data around this, like the venture capital industry tracks this stuff. And better firms tend to have more zeros because they're actually taking more risks. They're trying to find the things that are going to be really breakout. And so actually, if you look at it, funds that are better have more zeros, which is kind of a little counterintuitive to most people. Two, it's a little bit of, it's not exactly correct that even in traditional tech, you just have ones and zeros. And this, you know, we talk about legislation, but it's a really important thing to understand, I think, because even in traditional venture, you have, for example, let's say you're an early investor in Facebook, you might be really close to Zuck, right? And he really trusts you. And so if you have some company that that is sort of strategically valuable to Facebook, it's that much easier to get a company acquired. Not because you're doing anything bad, it's because there's a bunch of senior people at Facebook that might trust you. And so if you introduce a founder to them, they'll say, oh, I trust your judgment on people. I trust your judgment on technology. Like, I should at least talk to these people. So in practice, actually, there aren't just zeros and ones. And that's actually what makes Silicon Valley work so well, is there's a whole host of opportunities for people to get acquired between like 20 million and 200 million. And so from a VC perspective, you get a bunch of non-zeros that can actually return capital back into the fund. And then that creates, you know, entrepreneurs who make a little bit of money who then become angel investors and cycle the next thing through. So it's actually part of the secret of why Silicon Valley works, is there's a very robust acquisition market for things between like 20 and 200 million that most of the rest of the world doesn't have. And so it's also not exactly true that you're either zero or one in venture capital if you're a VC, because you actually have a lot of other things. Like, you're investing in good stuff that's fundamentally useful that other bigger technology companies might want. And so there are actually a lot of opportunities to sell things in traditional venture, setting aside tokens, to bigger companies too.
So I think one of the things
I'd add to that.
Yeah.
Well, so, you know, we talk a lot about how traditional venture capitalists, they tend to take, you know, 10 years, 12 years in order to actually get from a company to IPO. And it's worth remembering, this is a relatively recent artifact, right? It was basically after the great financial crisis that the requirements around going public in the US dramatically increased. And before that, it was actually more typical for younger companies to go public because the reporting requirements were just not as onerous as they were in the past. And people talk about this as a social problem in the capital markets, that retail investors don't get exposure to all these startups and all these vibrant new companies. Only accredited investors can get access because of the fact that the IPO requirements are so difficult in the US. In a way, crypto has been trying to kind of flatten this hierarchy to say, okay, accredited investors and institutions can get access to these vibrant startups. And, you know, crypto was sort of like, look, let's flatten these capital markets and allow anybody to get access. And of course, what happened? The SEC said, nope, that's not allowed. You can't do ICOs. You can't, you know, sell to retail. You can only sell to accredited investors and institutions. And so on some level, it's kind of very deeply connected to this fact that, like, yes, I agree with you that crypto VCs have this better path to liquidity relative to traditional venture capitalists. And I think that's good. I think that's good for financial markets. I think it's good for the health of access to investment opportunities. The thing that I think a lot of retail investors complain about is that, hey, by the time this token launches on public markets, it's already marked up at a really high valuation. But that's really a function more of the fact
of markets.
That
that's markets.
We're in a bull market.
That's a market. That's
exactly
a market.
That's markets. We're in a bull market. That's what people think the thing should be worth. But if you look at the token launches that happened last year or the year before that, they weren't coming out at these crazy prices. And so that's really just a function of where we are in the market cycle rather than fundamental thing.
In fact, you could be buying into things in the bear market in crypto lower than the VCs paid. There are a lot of things floating around that are high quality projects with amazing treasuries that were below.
Not even the bear market. Actually,
VCs are still locked up.
If you look at some
Solana, we've done treasury sales recently. I mean, that's been a pretty big strategy for us, knowing that like there's a lot of opportunity out there where people aren't looking. And then, yeah, I think for us, I mean, we've done this for 10 years. So, you know, the average holding period before selling has been years for us. Again, it like Avichal and Haseeb mentioned, I mean, it really just depends on the VC. And of course, like, I think for us, like, we discount sort of where we mark companies until they're finally fully liquid for us. And so, you know, for us, I mean, you know, valuations could be high, there could be low floats. I mean, I think right now we're at like 21 unicorns, but at the end of the day, I mean, you don't know until, you know, things become fully liquid. And for us, like, and I think the other thing that people don't think about too is like, oh yeah, like VCs can sort of sell right away. I mean, it's the ones that aren't doing as well, where you probably have as much difficulty trying to find an acquisition market and sort of selling a company that's like lower market cap. So I think we kind of run through the same sort of challenges, but nevertheless, I mean, we can kind of make that happen.
So I want to talk about meme coins, because Haseeb, you brought it up and you said, you know, the retailer might be rebelling and actually buying meme coins. I mean, would you agree that meme coins have had a higher share of mind or share of voice than is warranted in the last couple of months? And I mean, one of the theories that I have about why is because when the market was moving sideways, for specifically the last 90 days or so, the market moved sideways. We needed dopamine, and we weren't finding dopamine on the Solanas and the Near protocols and all the big protocols. And so where do we go to get our dopamine? Well, we go to, you know, we go to pump.fun and we create Roaring Kitty with hat and Roaring Kitty without hat and Roaring Kitty with, I don't know, with dog and no dog. And, you know, that becomes, and that becomes the meme coin meta. How sustainable do you think it is? I mean, and is it going to be here for, are these meme coins going to be here for the next part of the cycle? Paul, maybe I'll start with you.
Yeah, I think meme coins are going to be around. I think it's going to be similar to Venture where, you know, it's really based off. I mean, it's not every meme coin's going to, you know, I think it's nice to be able to have folks, you know, kind of create a meme coin, you know, create a narrative around it. And, you know, maybe it's, you know, something around the elections, maybe something else. But like at the end of the day, I mean, it takes a lot, whether it's a meme coin or a project, to continue to sort of engage and bring utility. And, you know, maybe something like, you know, this certain dog coins out there have been able to do that, to rally folks around certain initiatives and really sort of keep that narrative going and even have maybe like a purpose or maybe even have like laughter around it. So I do think it's going to be similar to Venture, where there's a few meme coins that just continue to sort of stay and kind of continue that narrative and find different ways to sort of iterate. But most meme coins are just going to go to zero.
So I have a different theory, and I'll open up to you guys. Yeah. But my theory is as follows. Like if I look at any project in crypto, you specifically need three things. You need technology, you need casino, which is dopamine, and you need religion or community, whatever, however you want to call it, right? Now, when I look at like a project like Starknet, and I think Starknet's a great example, because they have great technology, but they have zero casino and they have zero community. So, I mean, like for me, that's the way I see it. They may have the best technology in the world, but they have zero casino and zero community at the moment. Meme coins are coming in from a different point of view, and they're saying, look, naturally, because we're meme coins, we're part of the casino, so we've ticked the casino box. We've ticked the community, or we, you know, if we get a community, we may get the community box. But then I looked at the meme coin market and I said, hold on a second. How many meme coins have survived as just being simple meme coins for more than one or two cycles? And the answer is that I came up with is zero. So you may say, okay, well, Doge is a meme coin and it's been here for multiple cycles, but actually Doge is not a meme coin. Doge is a payment platform that may or may not be integrated into Twitter. And right now the probability that it's going to be integrated is valued at a certain billion, at a certain number of billions, which is the market cap of Doge. Then I looked at Shiba and I said, oh, well, Shiba started off as a cute dog, but Shiba's not a cute dog anymore. It's actually a technology layer. It's a layer two and Shibarium and whatever else. And then I looked at like Floki and I looked at Bonk, and they all have the same thing where they started off with religion and casino, and then they pivoted into technology. And I've yet to find one meme coin that has lived multiple cycles as just a meme. And maybe even if you want to extend beyond meme coin, just go into memes and say, how many memes have lived for multiple cycles in any medium? And like to me, a meme is something that needs to be quick. And so I think that they start off getting casino and community, and then it's up to them to create a product, so to speak. I don't know if that makes sense to you guys. Haseeb, Abhishek, I'd love to hear your views.
I think the story explains too much. if you look at Doge is worth right now about $22 billion. Okay. If Doge is a payments product, it is worth more than Twitter itself right now. So yeah. There is absolutely no way that Doge is being valued as a potential payments integration in Twitter. Like Doge is a meme coin, right? To the extent that there is technology that is riding sidecar with Dogecoin or with Shiba or with any of these platforms, it's because it's so big that somebody at some point came along and decided, hey, I should like try to build something. But it's not because that's not why. That's not, it doesn't have much explanatory power. If that went away, I don't think Doge would be worth even 10% less than it's worth today. The story you're telling of, okay, well, the reason why this meme coin activity is picking up is because markets have been sideways, people want volatility, they want to gamble. Again, this doesn't match the timeline because the meme coin mania began before any of this stuff was going sideways, right? And I would guess, you know, if your theory is correct, then if markets start going up again, then meme coin activity should die down. And I would predict actually the opposite.
But that's what happened yesterday.
Meme coin activity will also go up.
So I'll show you something actually very interesting. So this is the performance of the coins in the last 48 hours. So when the market started to recover, what you can see is that the AI coin started to recover, the DEX coin started to recover and all of that. And the meme coins actually started going down immediately. And that was where I got the theory from, because I looked at the flows and I was like, holy shit, the market's pumping, but the memes are dumping. Maybe people are saying, hold on, if quality starts pumping, what do I need to play the memes for?
I mean, look, it's not a bad explanation, but that is N equals one of an example of like,
yeah,
something happened in the market and you're trying to tell a bigger macro story about it. Like in reality, if you remember Doge, right, which was the primordial meme coin that we can all kind of look to as the real pattern across cycles of how meme coins behave, Doge more or less pumped in line with the market. And there are times when Doge pumps idiosyncratically relative to the rest of the market, right? Obviously, there's these kind of retail-driven events that draw attention to meme coins. But for the most part, meme coins are very pro-cyclical. What we're seeing right now with respect to all the demand around this meme coin carousel, right, where you have, you know, pump.fun, a new meme coin every single day and a new meta, that is what's really new. The meme coins themselves being a part of the market, that's as old as the hills. You know, that's been around forever.
Okay, so let me throw this at you guys. You guys all are VCs. You guys all have amazing funds. You're probably the leading three funds in the crypto space. Are you guys holding any meme coins on your books? Like, I mean, can you put your hand on your heart and go to your investors and say, look, guys, you know, we like Ton. Therefore, we bought Resistance Dog because we just thought it was a good proxy. Or I don't know, we like Base and therefore we bought Base Brett. Like, I mean, is it a reality that funds are putting or would put meme coins on their balance sheet?
We don't.
Yeah, we don't either.
Paul does. Paul's not.
We don't. We've explored it, but we don't currently.
Yeah, I think that it's kind of like NFTs too, right? It's sort of. I think most of them. It's just so hard to fundamentally value. Like, how do you put a discounted cash flow against that? Or how do you say like, this is the market they're going after? It's very hard to value these things. And if you can't value them, then, you know, you're kind of speculating and you're gambling at that point. And that's not really what we're paid to do. I also think, for what it's worth, you know, a different lens on this is, you know, if you look at the global gaming market, it's something like $300 billion a year of spend goes into like mobile games and video games. It's a lot of money. There's a lot of revenue sitting there. And this is just like real money games in my mind. Like, I don't think it's you know, people have now an outlet to be able to play with people all over the world and play with real money. And that's compelling. And so I think it's both pro-cyclical because that's what draws people in, but it's sort of one of these things that's like, it's going to go up and then it'll plateau and maybe go down a little bit and then it'll go up. But like the actual overall trend, I suspect, is going to be up and to the right in terms of the industry. I don't think any particular one is going to survive because it is a meme, but in aggregate, you know, I think this whole phenomenon actually is going to be around for a long time.
Yeah. So,
investor, what that might mean is like,
go ahead. You're saying as a venture investor,
what that might mean is you might choose to invest in something like a pump.fun. You might invest in the platform that is the like the thing that lets that happen, right? The game platform, you might sort of say you could invest in. But I think investing directly in the memes is
okay. So you took us there. Are you guys making any investments in meme coin infrastructure like a pump.fun? I mean, are there any other investable, like, we kind of know what pump.fun does. We looked at the fees this week in terms of if you look at the annualized fees, you're probably talking about $150 million this year if you can annualize. I don't know if that's real and if it will be annualized. But I mean, what other platform is there?
I mean, I feel like we've come across like 10 or 15 different pump.fun competitors. I mean, I think that would be an area that we would potentially make the investment in. You know, I won't speak about any certain companies, but in general, I mean, outside of just that particular space, when you're looking at like the team and, you know, the strategies for growth, and if it's starting off with meme coins as a wedge and kind of moving on to like other sort of assets, I do think that like there's an interesting strategy around memes becoming a tool for just marketing and engagement. And so I can imagine companies really trying to use memes almost like they use NFTs in the last cycle to really just go out there, you know, feel the community a bit and kind of, you know, draw attention to their projects. So that could be
To be honest, we did that. And I want to just share some results with you guys. We decided we're going to launch a meme coin. We launched a meme coin called Gummy. And the reason why is because I was when we had the idea to launch the meme coin, I was on a trampoline with my kids and I'd just taken a gummy and it was the only way I can enjoy the trampoline. We launched a meme coin. What we didn't know is that...
But what kind of gummy?
It was a weed gummy. It was a very strong, extra milligrams. Let's put it that way. It's the only way that you can enjoy jumping on a trampoline for... It's the only way you can enjoy jumping on a trampoline for 5 hours or however long your kids want to jump. You take a gummy and you have a great Saturday. One of my researchers dropped a video in the research group and he said, look, this guy made a meme in 10 minutes. I was like, shit, we got to teach our community how to make a meme. And they all argued with me about, that's crazy, they're going to scam people. I said, no, I played them the clip from Andreas Antonopoulos where he says that in the future, people will be able to launch social, kids will be able to launch social currencies. And it's an important skill to learn how to launch. And there's a lot to learn when it actually comes to a meme coin. You learn about sniping, you learn about getting listed on exchanges, et cetera, et cetera. So we landed up launching a meme coin. Just honestly, guys, it was like supposed to be the most, like, it was, I was supposed to press enter, launch a meme coin, move on with the rest of my life. But that meme coin became crazy. I mean, we've got 55,000 holders. There's a market cap of over $100 million. It keeps the $100 million thing. The best thing that it's done is it's united our community. And we've used the meme coin in multiple places to get our community to do things that we needed them to do, like test our app, test our Banter Bubbles app, and sign up to exchanges. And we reward them with the meme coin, and it's become like a symbol of allegiance to the community. So it is a very powerful tool, a customer acquisition tool, while the coins are actually running. And we found it's been, I mean, the stuff that we've achieved in the meme coins has been more than any business that we could have achieved in any with any other. You want to call it a promotional tool, call it whatever you want. But right now we have a meme coin that's become a beast and is trading at a $100 million plus market cap. So it is a very valuable tool if used correctly, I think. Now, I don't know what the future holds. The meme coin is going to be part of the community and you know let the community decide what the community decide. I want to maybe jump from things that you wouldn't invest in, because you've all said that you wouldn't invest in meme coins, to things that you are investing in or would invest in. And I think the one place that I really want to start is I want to start with Telegram, Ton. And the reason I want to start with Ton is because, I mean, I think, look, I've been very bullish on Ton. I think in terms of my highest conviction bets or my highest conviction plays, which I published, my highest conviction bets for the rest of the cycle, which I published a couple of weeks ago, I said, it is my number three biggest bet after Arweave, Solana, and my number four biggest bet is actually Near. And the reason why I like Ton is because 900 million users, it seems like they really are adopting Ton as the platform for Telegram. It does seem like they have access to the most users in the right in the right forum, and so we're very bullish on it. Paul, I know you guys are extremely bullish on it. I think you guys publicized that it was your biggest investment ever, right?
Yes, it's a very large investment for us. You know, the thesis is, you know, I wrote on Twitter, the thesis is pretty clear. I mean, it's you know, like, I think the tech is, you know, at least comparable to sort of what's out there. You know, we'll you know, they're going to have to sort of, you know, improve on just kind of getting developers like every other platform, right? That's like the North Star of getting, like, you know, Veach would know. I mean, it's all about the developers. But at the end of the day, I mean, they do have 900 million users and all across the world. And, you know, I think the other thing is the alignment between Telegram and Ton. I mean, to have Pavel go out there and really, you know, first time speaking in a very long time, you know, really sort of talking about like his vision for Ton and being able to have some of those conversations around like where, you know, Telegram wants to go with Ton. And, you know, I think it's, I think it's a interesting bet. I think it's something that isn't out there in terms of an existing user base that can really sort of integrate with crypto really easily and on-ramp onto crypto really easily. And it's just differentiated. It's so different than anything
what
else
do you think,
sort of invest.
What do you think Telegram as an app is worth? Like, let's take out Ton, the blockchain, and let's say that if Telegram went onto the market today, the actual Telegram app, what do you think that Telegram app is worth today with 900 million users? I mean, I don't know, because I've never valued these things.
Yeah. I feel like he's probably best positioned to answer that.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I don't remember what their revenues are offhand, but I think they're doing well. It's got to be, you know, if I had to guess, people will probably bid it up to like 10 billion, you know, maybe more.
Okay.
And part of the reason is their growth has just been so solid.
So you 10 know, billion.
Like I think it'd be on the equities markets. I'm talking about the equities.
Mm-hmm. So this mm-hmm. is my question. This is my question. This is now, again, Ton is one of my highest conviction calls. But if the Telegram app is worth 10 billion, and I mean, we're throwing numbers around here, and Twitter as mm-hmm. value is what Elon bought it for 40 billion. What was the number that he bought it at? 40 billion, I think it was.
Yeah, I mean, but I think everybody marked it down to like 20, 25. So I think it's been marked down.
Okay. So now I look at the fully diluted valuation of the Ton chain, and that's 34 billion. So this is where I struggle a little bit, and I say, hold on a second. Yeah. The app is worth 10 billion. The chain is worth 34 billion. I would imagine that off the record, on the record, off the record, but actually on the record, but actually off the record, and the founders don't own a big part of the chain officially. So now I start asking questions. If the app without the blockchain is worth $10 billion, if I took the app away, I guess the blockchain would be worth nothing, right? Because then you could just go to Solana, Sui, Say. I mean, there's so many blockchains out there. Do we feel that by adding a blockchain to an app, we are 5Xing the price of the ecosystem? I think that's my question here.
Shouldn't you be answering that?
Yeah.
It's your like highest conviction bet, right?
I mean, it's not only my highest conviction bet. It's also Paul's highest conviction bet. I need to know this because I'm shitting myself that, hold on, I can't make the math add up, but instinctively it sounds good.
I have a theory for this.
Yeah, okay.
I have a theory for this, actually. So, so if you think about, we talked about zero interest rates being really challenging, right? Because where do you put your money if you're making zero interest rates in treasuries? And so what it does is it puts everybody out on the risk curve. So you start taking more and more risk. And then the way that then gets expressed in the markets is that PE ratios go up. Like for each dollar of cash flow that a company is able to produce, you're willing to pay more today for it. And so the way that gets expressed like in the stock market is PE ratios go up. So instead of it being a 15 or 20 PE ratio, then the stock market's at like a 30 PE. Part of my theory on like why there's always this disconnect between token valuations and US equities valuations is that the marketplace participants that are participating in the crypto markets are operating from a very different set of premises. Like one, they're often in regimes that are not just zero interest rate, they're like negative 10% interest rate. Like if you hold your money, you're losing 10% a year relative to dollars, which is how goods and services in the world are priced. Two, you don't have access to the US equities markets. So it's not like you can take your money and go buy Apple or Tesla or something like that. In a lot of these places, you actually have not that many great options in terms of equities markets in general. And three, it's like, what other options do you have, right? Like, where's your money going to go? So this is like the most accessible place to potentially get some sort of an instrument that might appreciate or might actually give out cash flows. And so if you sort of reason through it, it's like, it's not crazy actually that people would have, in effect, for some amount of cash flow, be willing to pay a much higher PE, right? Like the rates that they're willing to pay are much, much higher. And so I don't think it's crazy that actually some of these valuations relative to, if you have a token network that makes $1 billion a year and distributes that out to the token holders versus a company that makes $1 billion a year to give out to the shareholders, I think the token network that makes $1 billion a year would have a higher FDV than the company that's listed on the US market that makes the same dollar amount because of this reason. Now, does that mean Khan should be worth something or not be worth something? I don't know. I don't know if it's worth 30. I don't know if it's worth three. I don't know if it's worth 300. I have no idea. But I think if you were to compare two equivalent things, the token network would end up being worth way more because of marketplace participants.
Yeah, I think like the way we're thinking about it too is, again, like access to global markets. And in addition to that, it's a platform that, again, other apps are going to build on top of that. There's likely going to be like enhancement of like transaction flow. So, it's more than just an app. It's actually a platform where there's a lot of other transactions that are happening. So I think you could underwrite to a higher valuation than, where the equity could sort of lie.
So what you're saying, if I'm hearing you correctly, what you're saying is Elon Musk should launch Twitter Chain urgently, and he could maybe get four times the money back that he invested in Twitter. He could just get it back from just launching a platform, which allowed everyone to...
Hold on. I think we need to do a little bit of mental math here in order to check these numbers out, right? So first of all, when you launch Chain, okay, so you look at Telegram, you say, oh my God, it's whatever, 30 billion FTV. The reality, of course, is if Elon Musk were to launch his chain and kind of following the norms of crypto, Elon Musk would probably have about 20% of the value of whatever that network would be, right? Or sometimes less than 20%. And so you have to discount it by 80% first and foremost, okay? Second, when you're looking at the FTV of Ton, that FTV of 30 billion, whatever it is including a bunch of tokens that are not yet issued or used. They're sitting in a treasury somewhere and they may be used at some point for something, but they don't actually, in some sense, exist yet on the market. And this is sort of analogous to a company that has unissued shares, right? They've approved these shares for usage, but they'll only actually be issued if the company feels that it's in the best interest of all shareholders, right? So for example, I might issue it to a new employee, but that employee doesn't exist yet. But in case a new employee comes along, I might give them those shares.
The difference is that these are guaranteed to be issued. and if the network stays up and the company shares are not guaranteed to be issued. So the company shares is at the discretion of a board, and these are just emitting on time or on a vesting schedule. You know what I mean? So it's like,
well, no, but these are ultimately at the discretion of the token holders. The token holders can go decide, we are going to cancel that inflation. We're going to withdraw those assets that are in the treasury. We're going to burn the assets in the treasury, right? And many protocols have done that. So it's not that different from a board that has unissued shares, where they have full discretion at the subject of the token holders to decide what to do with those assets. They can also decide to double the supply that's unissued, right? They can say, you know what? We are going to create more tokens than the current max quote unquote supply because there's stuff we want to do with it that we think is valuable to the network. This has also happened in various token networks. So none of these things I think should be accounted for as comparable to the current value of the network. So it's just looking at an FTV number, I think it's tempting to say, aha, this is like the enterprise value of Twitter. But it's not really the same kind of thing. You have to look underneath that valuation and try to understand what is the composition of this number to really come up with the apples to apples. But no, I think it's likely that if Elon Musk launched Twitter Chain, which to be clear, I think is crazy, but if he did, it would probably have a higher FTV than Twitter. But that doesn't mean that Elon Musk would make more money from that thing than he would have in his ownership of Twitter.
Okay, fair enough. Okay, so let's move on. So I think Telegram we've covered. I think another one that which we're all bullish on, and I'm specifically looking at the ones that we're all bullish on at the moment, is Near Protocol. I mean, look, I looked at the usage stats. The usage stats have gone through the roof. Avishal, maybe you want to just walk us through why all of a sudden the market is becoming so bullish on Near. And I mean, Near is a token that's really, really, really had a tough time. If you look at the I'm going to take you to the price of Near, and you look at the price chart of Near. It's been a real roller coaster for investors. I've been invested, I think, since very, very, very early. And I must say, it's been an absolute roller coaster because, I mean, it went up as high as $21 in the last market, but then it came down back to 80 cents or something like that, I remember, in the bear market. And now it's trading back at around $8. So keen to hear what happened between here and here, or here and here, which got us back to $8. What is the market like about this? Avishal, maybe I'll give us one to you because I know that you're quite...
I think three things. Yeah, we're close to those guys. We were seed investors back in the day, 2018. I think three things happened. So one, the market generally came back. So there's just market beta, right? Like Bitcoin's way up, ETH is up. So that happened. Two, there was an AI meme cycle. And so a lot of people said maybe AI plus crypto is a thing. And they looked around and they said, well, what's substantive? And it turns out Ilya is by far the most substantive. He's literally on the Transformer paper that invented large language models. There's nobody more substantive in crypto than Ilya on AI. And so then there were a bunch of funny memes that sort of started to spread. Like if people remember the Jensen Touch meme, which was hilarious, because he was invited to give a talk with Jensen Huang, the CEO at NVIDIA, and some of the other folks that were on that paper. And then the side effect of that, which actually, Ron, I think harkens back to what you were talking about, is it sort of became a little bit of a meme, but then people started paying attention and they said, wait a second, like the technology here is real. Like sharding actually is the right way to scale blockchains. And this thing has had uptime and there's actually real developers here and they're building stuff. And so people actually were paying attention and there were actually little pockets of development, things like Sweatcoin that were building and had real users millions and millions of downloads. And so when people started paying attention, they said, okay, well, maybe this thing is real. And so now I think it's starting to tip into this, like, well, actually, maybe this is like a Solana. Maybe this is like an Ethereum. Like there's real developers here and there's real use cases and things like chain abstraction. You know, like, why do I care what chain my stuff is sitting on? I should just be able to have assets across all of my chains and my wallet should be able to control those things. And oh yeah, I should be able to scale with sharding. And like that shard doesn't need to talk to that shard. And oh yeah, like DA that's really, really cheap makes a lot of sense. Like once people start sort of digging in a little bit,
So where do you think
come for the meme, stay for the technology?
Yeah, so okay, so I agree with you. Where do you think that Near is a superior blockchain to, for example, a Solana or maybe one of the other competitors? Where do you think that Near actually wins? And then what makes it, other than the meme of Ilya and the fact that he is such an AI person, what makes it, let's ask the question, is it a meme or is it really an AI play? Is Near actually an AI play? Like that's, I get the meme that Ilya is the guy, but is Near actually ever going to be used for AI?
Yeah. So on the first point, the Near versus Solana thing, we're big investors in Solana too. I think both can coexist and both can be really successful. They just take fundamentally different approaches in terms of these trade-offs about monolithic versus modular, and that has downstream consequences in the kinds of applications that would be built. We think both will be really successful because they cater to different types of use cases. So we don't think of it sort of either or. I think just different ecosystems will develop and they'll both be successful, and that's great. On the reality of the AI thing, it's an excellent question. And I think it's something that, there's real risk in this cycle that a lot of people look at these kinds of AI tokens and most of them are not real and they get caught up in it. And that those are sort of meme coins that have a veneer of legitimacy, but they don't actually. In Near's case, I think what they're doing is they are trying to hone in on the kinds of things that actually you do need crypto for. So for example, data labeling is a thing that a lot of AI products need. Like you need humans to look at data or crowdsource data and get that data to you somehow so that you can train these models. And the Near folks actually started prior to the Near blockchain. They were playing around with how to acquire this kind of data. And one of the founders, Alex Skidnoff, is very deep on this. And so they're actually building tooling and apps and encouraging an ecosystem of people around data labeling, because it turns out small micropayments to people all over the world is a really, really great use of blockchain. And so if you could build tooling where people can crowdsource data and bring data in to train AI models, then actually the Near rails to be able to pay people are really, really useful. So they're being pretty smart about how do you identify these kinds of pockets of real usage that really need crypto plus blockchain, and actually investing in those via the foundation, like actually trying to encourage those parts of the ecosystem. How long that takes to happen, TBD. I don't think it's going to be fast. I don't think it happens in the next 6 months. But directionally, I think if anybody's going to figure that out, it's probably Ilya and Alex.
So you're pretty much like when you invest in a company, you're pretty much betting on the team to say, look, they're going to pivot this thing. They're going to keep developing this thing, et cetera. Paul, I see you nodding. Haseeb, I think you guys are also investors. Anything to add on Near, or can I move on to the next one?
Let's move on to
Ethereum, because I really want to talk about Ethereum. Like I've been holding my Ethereum bag since just after ICO. I think they're $6 or $8 or something, like I don't even remember the number, but it was very low. I feel like I'm a comrade. I feel like I've been there from the beginning. I feel like it's like, you know, but the bags are getting quite heavy, like especially when I look at them relative to a Solana or relative to a Near or relative to, I don't know, everything else. It just feels like Ethereum is maybe not performing as well this cycle, you know. And then I look at that relative to my thesis around Ethereum, and I kind of go, okay, look, ETH has got TVL, has got the most tooling built around it. It has got the most vibrant VC infrastructure, but it is an unusable chain. And layer twos, as much as I love layer twos, they don't talk to each other. There are different ecosystems, and Base is Base and Arbitrum is Arbitrum, and they have nothing in common. They have nothing in common other than the fact that you can maybe plug your MetaMask into both and that they settle on the Ethereum network. And I'm kind of going like, is it maybe time to dump my Ethereum bags and, you know, maybe look at the more exciting blockchains? What are your thoughts? Like, is Ethereum going to make this crazy comeback at some point? And is everybody just going to be ETH maxis again? Paul, I'd love to hear your views here.
Yeah, I mean, look, we, as an investor, I mean, we have diversification. We're big in Solana, as you guys may sort of know. We're investors in Ton, and we're also looking at other monolithic chains. I do think that we're excited about Ethereum. You know, it's a long-term play for us, and we have a liquid portfolio, and that can be a lot more active. But we are investors in the entire ecosystem around Ethereum. We seeded Arbitrum, we seeded Starkware, and so I think it's just going to take a little bit of time. I think it's going to take a little bit of time for the infrastructure to really kind of get going, where now we have like modularity and, you know, folks focusing on different parts to really sort of like, you know, get Ethereum to scale. And then at the end of the day, I mean, you just need the user experiences and the abstraction to be able to make things a lot easier for the user. So we're long-term bullish on Ethereum, and we're going to continue to invest into the ecosystem.
Are you more long-term bullish on Ethereum or more long-term bullish on Solana?
Similar to Avichal, I think they can coexist. In DeFi, TVL, I mean, we're seeing Ethereum excel in certain use cases versus Solana and DePIN. And other things like gaming that need a little bit more throughput. So I think they can both coexist.
Okay, so if I have $10,000 and I need to invest the $10,000, how much should I put into Ethereum and how much should I put into Solana?
I pick both. I mean,
okay, Haseeb, what do you think? I mean, like, are we all emotionally attached?
What do you think? If I had $10,000, what should I do?
Look, unfortunately, you've got to pay us a lot more than getting on a show to give investment advice. But I would say, look, I mean, the obvious reason why Ethereum is lagging is because there's very unlikely to be an Ethereum ETF. And so to the extent that a lot of what's driven the market cycle has been institutional capital inflows, They can't come into Ether right now. And so we're probably going to be waiting another probably year at least before we get a real shot at an Ether ETF. And until then, I would expect Bitcoin to outperform Ethereum. I mean, that's not surprising, right? This is pretty straightforward. Just
is there a world
where the flows are coming in, where the capital is arriving?
Let me ask you a question. Is there a world where Ethereum goes up and Solana goes up less than Ethereum? And the reason why I say that is, you know, I just think that, you know, ETH becomes a proxy for altcoins. If ETH goes to 10,000, like that's a 3x from where it is today. I kind of see Solana going up much more than a 3x. If an ETH ETF gets approved, then I think the market says, oh, well, we know which one's next. It's Solana because it's, you know, how can they approve an ETH ETF and not approve?
No? That is absolutely not how the SEC works. No, I'm afraid to break it to you, but the SEC does not argue by analogy about which coins get approved next. Like the reality, the SEC has already declared war on Solana, right? They have stated explicitly they think Sol is a security. They have never said one way or another whether they think Ether is a security. People are speculating that maybe the SEC is going to do some cuteness around saying, oh, maybe Ether's security, TBD, whatever. But the reality is that they have much less of a leg to stand on with respect to Ether. And so they may get forced to approve an Ether ETF. This SEC, like if Biden wins and Gensler remains the SEC chair, they will go down fighting before they approve in a Solana ETF. Much more likely they would approve something like XRP or Litecoin or even Doge before they approve Sol for an ETF.
Wow, that's scary. I mean, you just said something very scary, which was, if Biden actually stays in power, if Biden stays in power, you've got Gary Gensler and Elizabeth Warren for another 4 years. Abhishek, you've been quite vocal about the Democrats.
To be clear, not 4 years. I think 2025 is when Gensler's term ends.
Yeah, Gensler has been 2 years.
But he could be reappointed, couldn't he? Or is it
whoever the appointment would be? Yeah, I mean, he probably wouldn't be reappointed, but the scary thought would be that you get somebody worse than Gensler, right? Like now you have like a second term sitting president and, you know, a late career senator who has a lot of power, who can go even more ideological and more extreme. So, you know, there's the really bear case here is that whoever comes in is even worse than Gensler.
Okay, hold on. So let's just quickly look at what's going on here. So I saw this yesterday or earlier this week.
Donald Trump lost two debates to me in 2020. Since then, he hadn't shown up for debate. Now he's acting like he wants to debate me again. Well, make my day, pal. I'll even do it twice. So let's pick the dates, Donald. I hear you're free on Wednesdays.
How do you think this plays out? Like, honestly, like, I need to hear your honest thoughts here. How does this play out? Like, I mean, you know... I mean, I don't mean to be.
I mean, it's a coin flip. Yeah, I mean, like right now. Yeah. Yeah. The problem is, you go look at the polling, you look at prediction markets, you look at everything. Right now, it's 50-50. It could really go either way.
Okay,
Trump
let's
seems
look
to
at
be slightly ahead, but not by much.
Let's look at the worst case scenario. Well, for me, certainly the worst case scenario. Biden stays in power. Elizabeth Warren stays right behind him. Gary Gensler stays alongside her. What does that look like for crypto? I think right now, the prediction markets are probably pricing in crypto at a certain price because they think that there's a certain probability that Gensler's gone and Warren's gone in the next thing. But what happens if not? Like, do you think that if November we get a Biden victory, do you think we lose 30% of the crypto market immediately?
No,
actually. I don't think it's that bad. Right. The reality is that I suspect you're going to see Biden moderate going into the election because he's going to realize that, like, hey, I got to win swing states, tight election, and I got to pander. You know, I got to be a populist. Everyone's a populist during an election. And on some level, you know, the polling around crypto has really started to become more fine-grained? Are we just getting a better sense of how much people care? And the answer is that they care kind of, right? It's like a voting block. It's not a huge voting block, but it's a voting block. And so to the extent that it's a close race, that is likely to mean that every little kind of tiny issue that doesn't matter that much to the base, like the base of the Democratic Party doesn't care that much about crypto. It's kind of a niche issue. But if you can win some independence by being pro-crypto, then fuck it. Yeah, let's win some independence. Let's get some votes. The second thing is that the reality is, you know, Biden started getting really tough on crypto after FTX. It's been 2 years now, right? You did the thing, you threw the guys in jail, CZ, SBF, like everybody, you kind of show that you're tough on crime.
It's clearly not that. Chill out. Come on, it's clearly not about being tough on crime. Like, tell me that Elizabeth Warren and Gary Gensler and Gary Gensler's rampage is about what happened at FTX. Like, I just can't reconcile.
Look at when all this stuff ramped up. It was basically February of 2023 that all of this started, right? Like the stuff that coming out from FinCEN, from the SEC going after Coinbase and Binance and blah, blah, blah. All this stuff started, surprise, surprise, after FTX collapsed. So if it was purely driven...
I think it's. I mean,
look at the timeline.
I mean, look. Avisha, I'd love to hear your view here.
Yeah. It certainly had an effect, and especially because SBF was so publicly aligned with the Democrats that they had to distance themselves, and so they had to show that they weren't bought, basically. But this is actually a much more fundamental ideological issue. And so it's, you know, even if Biden gets elected, the real question is how much power does Elizabeth Warren have? Because the way that these appointments work is they go through the Senate. So a little sort of like civics history government lesson for non-Americans, right? You have Congress, you have Senate. The president can say, hey, I would like this person to be in the agency at the SEC, but the Senate has to approve them. And the way that the current power structure is set up, they've delegated essentially regulatory authority over the financial markets to Elizabeth Warren. And so she has a huge amount of oversight and say into who these people are. So you know, Gary Gensler or Lina Khan at the FTC. Essentially, these people route through Elizabeth, and the other Dems in the Senate are not going to approve somebody unless Elizabeth Warren has sort of signed off on that. So the real question here, in my mind, is how much power does Elizabeth Warren have going into the next cycle? And I think the best case there actually is it kind of, I think it's slightly better for crypto if Trump gets in, because he's then going to start proposing people to the Senate. For these agencies that are more pro crypto, and that's clearly good for us, but I don't think the industry should just count on that, and I don't think you want to put all your eggs behind one basket. And so I think in parallel, what we're doing and what a lot of others are doing is trying to find the places in Congress where you can go in and win. And so if you look at, there's just a vote in Congress around SAB 121, which is a very sort of narrow, archaic, you know, guidance from the SEC. That has a very sort of bad set of downstream consequences. Specifically, what it does is it makes it very hard for large-scale custodians and banks and broker-dealers to participate in the crypto ecosystem. And so the SEC has made it very, very, very challenging for some of these legacy TradFi businesses to hold any Bitcoin on the balance sheet or to participate in these markets. There was just a vote in Congress. It'll go to the Senate. We'll see what happens. But in Congress, 21 Democrats voted with all the Republicans to overturn that guidance from the SEC. And so it got through Congress, and now it's going to go to the Senate. So the lesson here actually is, I don't think, you know, the president is a sort of a one-shot deal, and that's important. But actually the ground game of who wins in Congress and who wins in Senate is even more important, because that's where the laws get made. And so you can move upstream of the SEC. The SEC's job is to regulate. Their job is to try to interpret the rules and enforce them. And the real game is, can we just get the rules changed? Can we just put and codify into the law that
crypto can
be treated fairly and equally with these other assets?
I agree, but I do think that the head of the SEC here has got a big hand to play, and whoever's pulling the strings of the head of the SEC is, like, what's going on at the SEC now, I think we can all agree, is irrational. Like, it's not rational what's going on here. It's, you know, especially not from an MIT, an ex-MIT blockchain professor. You know, like... I mean, you were an MIT blockchain professor, and it seems like you hate crypto all of a sudden. Paul, anything to add before we go? I think we've got like one more minute. Anything to add around?
Yeah, no, okay. I think this is, they'll all have an effect. And I actually agree with the Vichel that like there's a lot of other stuff underneath that's probably going to have even more of an effect. But, you know, I think for us, like, you know, whether Trump or Biden wins, like, I think crypto is going to be fine. It may take a little bit of a detour here and there, but like we're pretty excited regardless of what happens here.
I mean, but like inside of you, do you have like a, do you want Trump to beat Biden? Like, I don't, like when you think about your LPs and you think about your shareholders and you think about your investment, I mean, when you think just about that, who do you want to win?
I think Trump is a bit more favorable, I think, for most crypto folks. But again, it is what it is, and we'll deal with what happens.
Yeah. Guys, listen, it's been amazing having you here. I could probably carry this on for like 3 hours and still be having a lot of fun, but we do have to go for today. So I just want to thank you guys again for, again, high alpha show, high intellectuality in the show, and I really loved it. So thank you so much. And of course, we'll see you guys again on Banter. To the Banter fam, we're going to see you guys again on Sunday doing another show, a meme coin show, but it's a very different meme coin show. We're actually going to discuss the psyche behind meme coins and stuff like that. So, we'll definitely see you. You will see you then. Until then, I guess what we can say is trade well, farm well, and I'll see you guys on Sunday.